Thank you. Now we're to the afternoon's item, which is item number 1202.
1202, authorize a surtax to the city's business license tax to publicly traded companies subject to U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission disclosure and reporting requirements if a subject company reports that the ratio of compensation of its chief executive officer to median worker is equal to or greater than 100-1 under the commission's pay ratio disclosure rule.
Mr. Novick.
Thank you, colleagues and guests. A couple of years ago, I read about the United States Securities and Exchange Commission's new rule for pay ratio disclosure, which was required by Congress as part of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Bill. The new disclosure requires publicly traded companies, in other words, the companies that sell stocks and are regulated by the SEC, to report the ratio of the compensation of their CEO to that of their median worker. That means that for the first time, we will get hard data from all of the country's largest companies about how much they're contributing to the growing gulf in income disparity between the super rich and everybody else. It also means we'll finally have a tool to begin policymaking to address growing income inequality, which is bad for our economy and bad for democracy. The surtax proposal that is before us today is an example of the kind of policy that is now possible now that the new SEC requirement is in place.
I think we've managed to make the connection. Keep going, please. Welcome, Sarah.
Thomas Lanham from the Revenue Bureau is here to describe the mechanics of the surtax itself, and we have a few people here to provide invited testimony. But first, I want to show just a few slides to illustrate the problem of income inequality and why it matters. Before I do that, I also want to state for the record that this proposal will come back for a second reading and vote during the council meeting on December 7th. That fact is included in the impact statement, but I wanted to state it for the record that that is my intention. So with that, Katie Shriver, please show the first slide.
Okay, there we go.
This graph from the Economic Policy Institute shows the big picture of how much income inequality has risen since the 1970s. There's been a dramatic difference in the increase in pay for the super rich and the rich compared with everyone else since 1979. Second, it's really increases in income for the richest of the rich, the top 0.1% of income earners, that is mostly driving the growth in extreme income inequality. This next graph from economist Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, shows that today in the United States, the top 0.1% hold between 7% and 8% of total income. In the 1970s, that figure was about 2%. Piketty's research shows that the extreme compensation for top executives is not just a dramatic example of, but a major driver of this level of extreme income inequality. In fact, he estimates that 60 to 70% of the members of that top 0.1% are top executives at large firms. In addition to income inequality, there is wealth inequality. Wealth is important because it gives us a foundation for prosperity and keeps us going when times are bad. But increasingly, wealth is concentrated among, again, not just the top 1%, but the top 0.1%. That tiny fraction of people in the United States, 0.1%, has 14% of the nation's wealth. And that's a conservative estimate. Some economists estimate that the top 0.1% has even more wealth and that their wealth might equal the wealth of the bottom 90% of income earners in this country. Wealth inequality becomes even more striking when you look at the racial wealth divide that is shown in this chart. The wealth of the 400 richest Americans on the Forbes 400 list, that's the bar furthest to the left, compared with the wealth of all Black American households in the middle and all Latino American households to the right. That means the 400 richest Americans have more wealth, a lot more wealth, than 16 million Black American households and more than 15 million Latino American households.
Can I try to call in with my cell phone?
Those numbers are stunning. And I think they're stunning for all of us. But why do they matter? Here's just one illustration from a New York Times Magazine article titled, Who Gets to Graduate? If you have a high SAT score, but you're from a poor family, your chance of earning a college degree by age 24 is 44%. Well, if you're from a rich family, it's 82%. The gap is even bigger for students who earn low SAT scores. 52% of these students who earn low scores go on to earn a four-year degree if they're from a rich family. But only 8% of low-income students with the same scores earn a degree. Obviously, inequality begets even more inequality, and so on and so forth. What this growth in inequality means, what the fact that the vast majority of the income and wealth over the past 40 years has flowed to the top means, is that there's more and more people in the middle who are struggling to get by. They have mothers and fathers working two jobs to try to earn enough money to keep a roof over their kids' heads. If you had seen equitable growth in income and wealth over the past 40 years, we would have a different country. Just doing a simple math exercise, if the income of the top 1% were reduced to the already pretty large percentage it was of total income in the 1970s, you could give everybody in America a 10% raise. The surtax that I'm proposing would give companies an incentive to narrow the economic divide within their own firms by reducing CEO pay and/or by raising their workers' wages. Of course, this reform alone will not close our nation's economic divide, but it would send a powerful message that our community is ready to take a stand against the extreme inequality that harms all of us. Now, I'm under no illusions that what just Portland does will have dramatic impact on the behavior of the Fortune 500. But what we've seen over the past few years with local minimum wage campaigns, with paid sick leave, is that a progressive idea that starts in one place will spread to others. If other state, local, and state governments, as well as Congress, begin to use this SEC information to drive policy, we will see change as shareholders recognize the collective effect of policies like this proposed surtax. We know that California and Rhode Island have considered policies based on the SEC disclosure, and Republican Congressman Mick Mulvaney from South Carolina actually authored an amendment designed to prevent the U.S. Export-Import Bank from subsidizing a U.S. company that has CEO pay more than 100 times that of its median worker pay. And just last week, staff from a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, which is San Francisco City Council, called my office to inquire about the surtax proposal before us today. Together, we can make a difference on this issue. Before asking Mr. Lanham to come up and explain the mechanics, I do have an amendment to propose. The ordinance before you has a statement that is somewhat out of date. It says, now therefore the council directs, item B, the city budget office will increase the ongoing current appropriation level target for the Portland Housing Bureau by $2.5 million starting July 1st, 2018 to support the Joint Office of Homeless Services efforts to help people move off the street, out of shelters, and back into permanent housing, as well as services that help people avoid homelessness. When I proposed this surtax, there was a $3.5 million gap between the commitment we had made to funding homeless services in the coming years and the amount that we spent in ongoing funds this last year on homeless services. And I proposed that the approximately $2.5 million that we expect this surtax to raise would help to close that gap. In the meantime, in the context of the fall bump, we actually have already raised the CAL target for the Joint Office of Homeless Services by $3.5 million. So technically, the proposal that I had here is no longer necessary. However, in the broader picture, we know that we are looking at potential budget deficits next year. The City Budget Office has already told us that has suggested that we ask public safety bureaus to anticipate 2% budget cuts and other bureaus to anticipate 5% budget cuts. And I know, speaking as the commissioner in charge of the Bureau of Emergency Communications, that that bureau could not tolerate a 2% budget cut, and I'm sure my colleagues feel the same way about their bureaus. So although, given what we did in the bump on homeless services, the funds for this proposal is no longer targeted to a specific service, raising this additional revenue will help us bridge the gap between our revenue and our demands in the coming years so that we will not have to make cuts in critical services.
I'll second the amendment, but just to be clear, it's not going to help us with our deficit next year because it wouldn't happen until the 18-19, right?
We expect that next year it might raise a little money, but yes, because the disclosures won't kick in until 2017 and won't really be reported until early 2018, we don't expect the full $2.5 million approximately to kick in to 2018. That's absolutely correct.
All right, so we've got the amendment on the table. You want to wait and conduct the hearing and then act on the amendment. Any other questions, suggestions, any other staff presentations you have? And then I know you have, we hope we have, Ms. Anderson on the phone as invited testimony.
We need to test that. Ms. Anderson, are you there? Hello? I understand she can hear us, but we can't hear her.
All right.
This is Sarah Anderson.
Oh, there we go. Yay. Thank it
you.
Worked.
Yay. Thank you, Sarah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Mayor, first, I'd like to ask Thomas Lanham to come up and provide a report on the mechanics of the SERP tax.
Okay.
And Mr. Lanham actually has a small amendment to propose as well, I believe.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. I'm Thomas Lanham with the Revenue Division of the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services, and joining me is Terry Williams. We have some other staff here as well, so if you have questions, be happy to answer those. I'm just going to talk at a very high level about the mechanics of this thing. But before I begin, let me thank you all for passing an ordinance in 2015 allowing for parental leave for employees. My son, Francis Morgan Lanham, was born on August 12th, and I availed myself of the full 6 weeks. And that was just a wonderful time that I never would have taken a full 6 weeks had that not been in place. And so we had one heck of a summer. Thank you very much, especially to you, Commissioner Fritz.
You're very welcome, and thank you for setting the standard as the Director of the Revenue Bureau to show all of your employees, whether male or female or other gender identities, will take that time with new children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the ordinance before you today imposes a business license surtax on publicly traded companies doing business in Portland. The surtax applies only to those publicly traded companies reporting CEO to median worker compensation ratios of 100-1 or greater to the SEC as required by the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. The surtax would potentially apply to approximately 550 of the 92,000 businesses that we have operating in Portland today. The proposed surtax is 10% of the business license tax liability, so in essence, it's a tax upon a tax, and would only apply to those publicly traded companies with, again, the 101 or greater ratio. And the surtax rate would rise to 25% for those companies that had compensation ratios of 250-1 or greater. The computation of the tax is very straightforward. A subject taxpayer with a business license tax liability of $1,000, for example, would owe an additional $100 for $1,100 total if their ratio was 100-1 or greater, but less than 250-1. So the mechanics of the administration of the surtax will be very low burden, both for the taxpayer and for the revenue division. They're low burden for the taxpayer because they're already required to report this information to Dodd-Frank and to the SEC, rather, and we are not asking them to modify in any way that reporting. And the ratio calculation could be reported on existing tax returns for the revenue division. So we're estimating approximately half of an FTE worth of work, mostly just in confirming the reports that they're published at on the SEC website. The proposed surtax is estimated to yield an additional $2.5 to $3.5 million in general fund revenue when it fully ramps up in fiscal year 18-19. And this estimate was based on recent actual business license tax filings for subject taxpayers. And we estimated the CEO compensation pay ratios computed by a third party. So that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we'll be available throughout the hearing to answer questions that might come up later.
And Thomas, could you mention the amendment?
Yes, I'm glad you pointed that out. My notes tell me to do that, but I just didn't do it. So this is a very straightforward technical amendment. Under now, therefore, the council directs, we just want to put in some language that makes it clear that we're coming back in the 17-18 budget process to make some adjustments to add this new program should it pass council. So under now, therefore, council directs, add new language, C, the revenue division and the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services and the City Budget Office will prepare necessary adjustments to the Revenue Division's budget in the fiscal year 2017-2018 budget process.
Okay. I second that for a discussion. Would you expect that would start in the calendar year 2018, or would there be some work for a person to do in the last half of 17?
The work will begin in the last half of 17 as we really begin to publish information about this. We'll be getting fielding taxpayer phone calls, and we'll have to probably publish some administrative rules for clarity, so there will be work in 17-18.
And then there'll be notices we'll send out as well, and then need somebody to work on that.
So do you have an estimate of how many staff FTEs would be needed to staff this?
About a half.
A half an FTE, okay. And then, remind me, your bureau is somewhat overhead funded and somewhat not, or your all general fund?
All general fund. Okay. There's a mix of other interagency revenues from water and BES and other bureaus that we collect from.
So I appreciate Mr. Novick putting, since the Housing Bureau's budget is going to be taken care of next year, this is not going to be targeted. It's going to go into the general fund bucket, and the general fund bucket pays you, so we don't have to worry about making sure that the administrative expenses pay for it, because it will. Thank you.
Commissioner Prince, I appreciate your seconding the amendment. I don't think I actually moved it, though, so I moved the amendment.
All right. It's moved and seconded. Not necessarily in order. other questions?
So you mentioned how did you arrive at your estimate of $2.5 million?
We took actual tax filings for subject corporations that we identified, publicly traded companies, and we took their actual tax filings that we received in either tax year 13 or 14. Then we took a third party analysis of estimates of the compensation ratios for each industry or sector, and we have retrofitted that back to those individual taxpayers. So it was built line by line. We feel that it's a pretty high confidence, certainly on the 2.5 side of the range.
Is the Economic Policy Institute is where we got the data from to do the CEO ratios based on industry.
Are they an advocate for this, or are they impartial?
I don't think that they have actually endorsed this concept. Again, we'll have much better information because we'll have comprehensive information on the ratios next year, but a variety of nonprofit analytical organizations have been trying to estimate these ratios over the next 30 years, and we have some degree of confidence.
Our auditor, who's here today, Jason McKay, did review, for reasonableness, the numbers that were published by EPI, and we found them to be reasonable.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Thomas, and thanks for all the work that your office has put in on this issue over the past year or so during which we've been talking about it.
Happy to help.
I'd now like to ask Sarah Anderson from the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. to present testimony by phone, as the mayor indicated.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I also appreciate all the hard work that the Revenue Department has done on this proposal so far. First, I thought it would be helpful to say something about my background. I work at the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C., and over the course of the past 23 years, I've done extensive research on executive compensation. I was also very involved in pushing for the new SEC regulation that will require publicly held corporations to report the ratio between their CEO and their median worker pay. The Portland surtax proposal being considered here today is exactly what many of us who worked hard for this federal disclosure rule hoped would happen. By linking this new metric to local tax policy, you have the opportunity to use public policy to narrow what has become a very dangerous economic divide. And I believe you would set a precedent that would inspire many other cities and states, and maybe even the federal government, to take similar action. I believe this surtax is not only important because it addresses the problem that Commissioner Novak has already covered on inequality and economic unfairness, it's also important because our current extreme gaps between CEO and worker pay are bad for business. On the CEO end, executive compensation encourages behavior that may boost short-term profits and executive paychecks, but is harmful to workers, consumers, and the broader economy in the long term. The Wells Fargo scam is just the latest example. For years and years, top executives raked in tens of millions of dollars in stock-based pay that was inflated by criminal activity. Outrageous pay packages also encouraged the reckless behavior that led to the 2008 financial crisis. And this perverse short-term reward system is a problem throughout corporate America, not just Wall Street. Secondly, when companies have extreme gaps between their CEOs and their workers, it undermines employee morale, which in turn can reduce productivity and increase turnover rates. There's a lot of academic research on this, and I'd be happy to provide sources in writing, but this is why Peter Drucker, the founder of modern management science, believed that ratios above 20 or 25 to 1 were bad for business. why Whole Foods has capped their pay ratio at 19 to 1. But of course, not all business leaders agree with this, and I'd like to spend just a few minutes responding to three arguments that you may hear from lobby groups representing large corporations. The first is that this surtax would drive companies away from Portland. This is a familiar argument from the local living wage fight, and yet cities that have adopted significantly higher minimum wages have not experienced layoffs or slower job growth. And the surtax is even less likely to drive companies away because, unlike the wage increases, the surtax would almost exclusively affect very large corporations that consider many factors when deciding where to do business. Moreover, let's face it, change needs to begin somewhere. And there's a lesson, if there's a lesson in the living wage campaigns, it's that reversing our nation's extreme inequality will require bold action outside Washington, D.C. A second argument we often hear in the CEO pay reform debate is that government has no business meddling here, that CEO pay is strictly a shareholder issue. Well, the financial crisis should have put an end to this argument, and that's just the most dramatic example of how CEO pay affects all of us. Lawmakers have as much responsibility to encourage less risky CEO pay practices as they do to protect us from harmful chemicals and labor practices. Finally, I know that some have raised questions about why the surtax applies only to publicly traded corporations, and I think that's just a practical matter since the new SEC disclosure rule only applies to publicly held firms. But even if it did apply to small firms, they're unlikely to ever have to pay it. Let's do the math here. A company with median worker pay of $25,000 per year would have to pay their CEO at least $2.5 million to be subject to this tax. I looked up how much the average salary of chief executives in Oregon make, and it's $168,000. Finally, to sum things up, let's look at the three ways that businesses with pay gaps of more than 100 to 1 could respond if this surtax is adopted. First, they could lift up worker pay, which would benefit the economy by boosting consumer spending. Second, they could lower CEO pay, which would reduce incentives for reckless behavior and free up resources for job creation, research and development, or other long-term investments. And three, they could make no changes in pay whatsoever, which would result in more revenue for Portland to address the needs of your most vulnerable residents. Any of these, in my mind, would be extremely positive. And in conclusion, I just want to emphasize that by adopting this surtax, you would be setting a historic precedent, one that addresses a key driver of extreme inequality, which is a broken CEO pay system that benefits the very few at the expense of the rest of us. And I truly believe your action would inspire similar policies elsewhere in the same way as the living wage campaigns that is spread around this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I appreciate your coming out here before and being back with us this way today.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing individual meetings with each of us when you were here before. It must be very satisfying having done the underlying policy work in D.C. to now see Commissioner Novak and possibly the City of Portland putting it into action just as you had hoped.
It is truly exciting, and as many of you know, we don't see a lot of progress here in Washington, so we were thrilled last year to see the SEC finalize this disclosure rule, but I think the next steps will be taken at the local and state level to really put teeth into this disclosure and make it meaningful, although I will mention that there is just recently there's been a bill introduced in the U.S. Congress that mirrors very closely your proposed surtax there in Portland.
Fabulous.
Other questions for Sarah? Thank you very much. You have other testimony, Steve?
Yes, I would like to invite Tom Chamberlain and Jeff Anderson of the House of Labor to come up.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name's Tom Chamberlain, and I'm the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're a federation of unions that represents over 135,000 working men and women in Oregon. While our members are fortunate to have a contract on the job, we also pay a lot of attention to those folks who don't. That's why you see the AFL-CIO focusing in on an agenda that increases the minimum wage, retirement security, banning the box to give ex-felons a fair shot at a better life, housing, health care, and job creation. As my experience testified in front of you many times, and as my experience always bears fruit, that my testimony changes because you've got a real good foundation of what this does. I just want to add a couple of things. In 1960, the ratio between CEO pay and the typical worker was 20 to 1. According to the AFL-CIO Executive Watch, today, Oregon CEOs, the ratio is 327 to 1. And a report by the University of Oregon Labor and Education Research Center focused on the fact that 25% of our workforce today earns less than $12 an hour. Our economy's changing. And if you're a worker, perhaps not for the best, because what you're seeing is more and more low-wage jobs being created, which is going to have an impact on how we generate taxes, how we provide services. And when we have low-wage workers, we know that services are more in demand. If you're a low-wage worker, it's very hard to take care of your elderly parent or a disabled child. Often in the past, we were able to take care of folks like that in the home. Now we have to provide, rely on the government to provide those services. We have to start thinking creatively about how to capture new revenue, and I think this is a very creative way to do that. I would ask you to do one thing, though, and that's to focus this new revenue on those folks who need it most, the jobless, the homeless, those disabled. We stand in support of this measure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good morning, Mayor and members of the council. My name is Jeff Anderson. For reference, I'm president of the Northwest Oregon Labor Council, and I'm secretary treasurer of United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. Local 555 is comprised of 25,000 members, primarily in the retail industry throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington, with a little over about 12,000 in the Portland metro area. We stand in support of this concept because it's really about moving to what we would call a point of self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency is the idea that you don't have to rely on government to provide you the basic necessary means to support your family, that your job provides the economic means to a self-sufficiency. And one study, it's about a year and a half old, that we were looking at on the minimum wage discussion showed that in Portland today, self-sufficiency would be about a $17 hour job. What we know is that since the late 70s, as President Chamberlain has brought forth, is that there's a disparity, and the income has become much broader and wider between the top and the bottom. And one document I'm having passed out shows that CEO pay has grown 90 times faster than the typical worker since 1978. This information all but buttresses and supports President Chamberlain's comments about this disparity. I call it moving from a shared economy to an indentured workforce economy. And we see it just in my membership, which we're unionized. We have benefits. We move to a higher level of self-sufficiency, yet that deficiency is there. If somebody working in the retail industry under our contracts, the average hours reported is about 122 hours a month. Well, that's not 40 hours. That would be 173 in a month. That tells you that we have a part-time built-in system. And I was looking at that. I was looking at a top-end rate of a non-food clerk that's making $12.90 an hour. And that's about $7,000 less than what the self-sufficiency would require in the city of Portland to make your ends meet. It's picked up by the government. You're subsidizing, in essence, as policymakers, you're subsidizing the private sector to privatize and produce bigger profits. And it just seems like we need to start incentivizing companies that reinvest in our society. Over the last 20 years, the city of Portland has lost over 40,000 manufacturing jobs. And that's, in fact, I would say it's over the last 16 years based on data that's within the employment division. So we need to have a reinvestment policy that incentivizes companies not to be incentivized in the short term and provide the export of jobs, whether they leave the country, leave to another area. But at the same time, we need to take the incentive of saying we could be the next Wells Fargo, we could be the next Qualcomm, we could be the next Enron, and incentivizing short-term gains and disinvestment in local communities. It's with that we support this measure. One of my members who was here a couple weeks ago, who has breast cancer survivor and struggling to take care of herself and her family, has the difficult time of not just the hours and the irregular hours, but the short income that it takes to make all ends meet. It's with that I encourage you from the United Food and Commercial Workers to support this endeavor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff, I have a question. Our guest from the Institute for Policy Studies said that...
Not related to me, by the way. No.
said that that if we adopted this approach, it might help raise worker morale and it might boost productivity. So you represent a lot of people who work in our community. How might that happen?
Well, I'll give you an example. I won't say the name of the employer because really this is a policy about not goring a employer but setting a practice and in a model. In 2015, the CEO of one of our employers was compensation was $11,128,000. That's why a typical part-time worker working 122 hours is getting the equivalent pay of about $19,000 a year in retail. And if you think about that, how far can you go just basic needs after taxes paying rent in the city of Portland today? We know that there's a crisis taking place. So anything, and it's not a gotcha policy, but it's certainly a message saying we need to have a community investment. If you go back in the day, companies were part of communities, were part of that community ingrained up and down, worker to at all levels. Today, that's not the case. So if there's something that moves and sends a message that policymakers across this country are going to start working on the income inequality in that band, I think it's a real positive step. Portland could be the actual leader in establishing the right practice, the right thing to do doctrine.
I can also answer your question, Commissioner Fish, from my personal experience. I left city government and took a position in the private sector now 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and joined a company called HDR Engineering. At that point, there were 2,700 employees. And one of the reasons I joined the company was that it was employee-owned. And I particularly like that model of corporate ownership. And all the stock was held by employees. And, in fact, no one was paid stock as bonuses, only paid in cash based on the prosperity of the company. But the company was entirely owned and remains entirely owned by the people that work there. And our CEO pay was, I think, about 10 times the average of the professional workers in that company. And during the time I was there, the company grew from 2,700 employees to 8,000 and only had 1 year in which profit fell below 15% each year. Now the company's about 10,000 employees. So it obviously proves that that model leads to prosperity, and I was happy about that on a personal level. It certainly has helped my family and helped me put a couple kids through college. But from a morale standpoint, it was even more profound that everybody worked a little harder than they should. Your success was my success. It created an atmosphere where we all knew the CEO was only paid a little bit more than the rest of us. And in fact, most of the executive staff were still required to have billable hours. So it just created that egalitarian culture, created a very powerful work ethic that drove the company to considerable success in the marketplace. So I would say it was a win-win proposition. It was a win for the shareholders, who in that case happened to be the people that worked there, but it was also a win in terms of what it was like to work there. And it was a great experience.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thank you. The House of Labor.
Thank you both. That's a nice, has a nice sound to it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mayor, we've also invited Marion Haynes from the Portland Business Alliance, representing the Loyal Opposition.
Okay, come on up.
Marion, are you persuaded by the arguments you've heard today?
Good afternoon, Mayor, members of council. I suppose thank you for that introduction, Commissioner Novick. I probably am the outlier of the people that have been invited to speak to this issue, but I thank you for the time nonetheless. The Portland Business Alliance represents over 1,850 small, medium, and large businesses in the Portland area. We focus on advocating for economic prosperity throughout the region. I would note that about 80% of our members are small businesses. In that way, we're very much like the chambers of commerce that you see in communities all across the country. We do oppose the proposed business income tax surcharge based on pay ratio between CEOs and median workers. Growing income inequality is an issue. We agree with that. We, during the last legislative session, sat down at the table with some of our colleagues in the unions and came up with a framework for an increase to the minimum wage. We were happy to do that. It was a challenging discussion, but we think it was the right thing to do, and we were also okay with creating a differential in which the number in Portland was higher. We recognize that Portland, its cost structure and its economy is different than Ontario or some other communities across the state. We also, about a year ago, produced a middle-income jobs report because of growing concerns that we were seeing growth on both the high end and the low end of the job scale and not as much growth in that middle-income category that has been the path to the American dream and getting ahead and being able to put your kids through college. So we certainly understand the issue. Our approach to how to address it, I think, would be different than what's been proposed, and we don't think that this proposal will actually get us very far down the road on addressing what is a big global national issue. The ordinance does acknowledge that if other jurisdictions follow Portland's lead, then maybe some changes will happen. But there's no guarantee that that will happen. Something similar to this has come up in California. It was rejected. It didn't move forward. We don't believe that there is a nexus between the Dodd-Frank rule requiring disclosure of the ratio of pay and the city's business income tax. In many cases, those CEOs, those decisions are being made in other states and other parts of the country that really has no rational tie to the business income tax here in the city of Portland. The Dodd-Frank rule with the ratio is primarily intended to be used by shareholders in making decisions for their investments when they're comparing similar companies. It wasn't originally intended, I don't think, aside from maybe what some of the advocates hoped for, to be a tax policy tool. It was an informational tool for shareholders. And because it was not built for tax policy, it doesn't necessarily treat all businesses equally. It does include only publicly traded companies, and not all publicly traded companies are even included in it. I would disagree that the ones that are not publicly traded are not included are all small companies. There are large S corporations, LLCs, things like that are not included in this. I have heard from members, including those that have looked at their numbers, that will not be impacted by this proposal, that do have concerns about the perception that it will create in the city for businesses. Many of these businesses that we're talking about, the 500 on the list, employ thousands of people in the city. They make charitable contributions in the city. They are a part of this community, and many of them reflect that in how they operate and how they interact with the city and nonprofits and things like that here. It's also impossible to know, and this has been noted until the rule has been put in place, who is impacted. We don't know what companies and industries will have to pay, in what amount or what that impact might be. What this does at this point is impose a cost without any benefit, because, again, we don't think that this will have an impact by the City of Portland's action on corporate pay structure. So, in a sense, you're not buying anything for the cost that you're imposing. And I would argue that this is different than, say, a sick leave or something like that, which, you know, we had struggles with at the time, but worked on the policy to try to make it work as well as it could. But in that action, it had a meaningful impact on the workers in the city that you were trying to do something for. This is sort of a stab at trying to hope something will happen, trickle down the road, depending on the actions of a whole bunch of other people. So it imposes a cost. It creates a challenge, perhaps, for some businesses without any kind of meaningful benefit for the people in the City of Portland at this point. So we would urge you to reconsider this proposal at this point. We think there's better opportunities, better ways to provide opportunities for Portlanders. Heard a little bit from our friends in the union community about manufacturing, needing to support those types of things that can really grow middle-income jobs, increase people's opportunities for their families, and we really think that's in the city's wheelhouse, and that's something where a meaningful impact could be made. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate Commissioner Novick inviting you to participate, even though he knew you didn't support this. Also appreciate you acknowledging the problem that CEO pay is up 997.2% since 1980, and typical worker pay is up 10.9%. So appreciate you acknowledging the problem of income inequality. You said in your testimony that your approach would be different. What would your approach be?
Well, our approach, if coming from an action that the City of Portland could take, would be, like I said, doing things to encourage manufacturing, doing things to encourage middle-income job growth, making we've made some progress with the gas tax and making needed investments in the transportation system, but ensuring that freight can move efficiently, things like that. I don't have a full list off the top of my head, but there are actions I think that the city could take that could increase opportunities for people here now.
Do you know of anywhere in the country that's taking that approach where the income inequality gap is narrowed?
I'm not going to defend the income inequality gap. What my suggestion is that there are actions that the city could take that could have an immediate benefit to the citizens in the city, whereas this will impose a cost without providing any real benefit to the workers or to actually addressing that income inequality gap, which has grown and is something that we...
Mayor, if I could just make one comment. I appreciate Steve inviting you, and I'm just, since we're in the baseball season, I just want to thank you for batting. But on my scorecard, I think you're batting 600. I think you supported the gas tax. We deeply appreciate your support for the housing bond. And it sounds like you have a philosophical disagreement on this tax, but your support particularly on the housing bond was important.
We appreciate that. No, again, I think the dilemma for me is that, you know, the city's booming. You know, the city's in an economic boom unlike any we've seen. Unemployment is way down. City revenues are actually up. You know, all the indices, including the number of cranes on the horizon, you know, are positive. We got 1,000 people a month moving here, in part because the local economy is so great. And yet this pervasive problem of income inequality is not ameliorated by those general trends. General trends, or those averages, if you will, don't do anything about what the distance between the top and the bottom of that average. And if prosperity and trickle-down would solve the problem, we'd be trickling down all kinds of benefits on working people right now. But doesn't seem to work out that way, and we've kind of conducted an experiment in the last few years of Portland's recovery to show that that alone won't solve the problem. The general prosperity, we had a lot of new middle-wage jobs. They happen to be software engineers as opposed to manufacturing jobs, but nevertheless, they're really great jobs. And yet, for the low-income workers in the city, there's been really no progress. So I think that's the economic dilemma that we as economic policymakers are facing, is that it's just general prosperity and hope aren't going to solve the problem.
Mr. Mayor, we're actually going to be updating our annual economic checkup that we do. And some initial numbers are showing that we're seeing wage growth both in the low and the middle income end. Quite large numbers, larger than has been seen in the decade. And frankly, in Portland, those numbers are climbing higher than any of the comparator or peer cities that we use. So I think I agree with you that we've had a lot of success. There has been a lot of job growth. We're seeing wage growth now, which is absolutely terrific. And my only point is that I don't think because, as you said, we're seeing all this prosperity, we haven't seen a lowering of the income gap, that it's not something that the city has any control over.
Thank you. Other questions? Marion, thank you very much. Do you have other invited testimonies?
I think that concludes our invited testimony, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Now, other folks that are here that would like to speak?
Two people signed up, Peter Miller and Carly Edwards.
Okay. Come on up, please.
Great. Thanks for listening to me today. My name is Peter Miller. I'm a retired software engineer, and I am not a real CEO. But
you can play one on TV, though.
But I really support this idea. I think it's an idea whose time has come, and with this new information from the government that provides this kind of metric of the CEO pay, I think it's a perfect opportunity. And I'm pretty sure if Portland adopts this, it's not going to be the first or the last city, certainly, to adopt something like this, because I think it's the tax that fits the crime. You know, it's a very simple, easy-to-understand tax that has a direct impact and will help the city get some money back from these rich CEOs and corporations that pay them these exorbitant amounts. I was just thinking of a Wells Fargo CEO who just walked away. They think he's going to walk away retiring in so-called disgrace with $200 million in cash, stocks, and all the benefits from being a CEO of a large company and making that kind of a disparity. And Elizabeth Warren said that to him, CEO Stump, you squeezed your employees to the breaking point so they would cheat customers, and you could drive up the value of your own stock and put hundreds of millions of dollars in your own pocket. And I think it was mentioned by Sarah Anderson, and the disparity creates these kinds of opportunities for desire for malfeasance among our CEOs. Looking here in Portland, I have a friend who's a night baker, and he's worked at that job for many years, very stable employee, and a couple things. I help him do his taxes every year, and as a retired software engineer, I'm in the middle income, and he's not. And he pays a lot more percentage of taxes than I do, simply because people who have more money can take advantage of all the deductions and all the things that, and the CEOs are doing that big time. So by forcing them to bring the money back down and to the level of more middle income people, I think the governments will see an increase in tax revenue in some way, because the money's being sucked into these, the 0.1%ers, and they tend to pay fewer taxes right now, unfortunately. So I really appreciate this. I think this idea would spread like wildfire, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And I want to note that you were here to testify on October 5th when this hearing was originally scheduled, and we appreciate your persistence in coming back on the rescheduled day.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you for addressing this issue, Commissioners, and particular thanks to Commissioner Novick for his leadership on this issue. My name is Carly Edwards, and I'm the State Director for the Working Families Party. Our political party represents 11,000 registered voters and roughly 30,000 supporters. They're working people, parents, small family farmers, and this is exactly the kind of common sense creative policy that our voters and supporters are interested in and that invigorate them. A lot of our voters are sort of disenfranchised voters, first-time voters, people just getting involved in democracy and in the process of civic engagement, and these are the kinds of creative ways that they're looking for government to be able to address the things that they care about most. One of the things that we hear about our voters and supporters talk about is their kids going to college. Our voters and supporters are folks who are worried about keeping a roof over their head and being able to put food on the table. And being able to send their kids to college is something that's very important to our folks. And, you know, this is something that we think that is along the lines of the issues that they care about. In a past life, I used to be the affiliate leader for the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Employees Union here locally. And when I hear about this policy, it makes me think about the largely women of color who are moms who work in hotels and that they are working for barely over minimum wage, while CEOs of Hilton, like Christopher Nassetta or Arnie Sorensen of Marriott, make millions. At one point when I was with the union, workers of the Hilton downtown actually voted to authorize a boycott that eventually cost almost $2 million in lost revenue for the hotel. That meant lost shifts for them. That meant lost tips. That was a hit, and that's how hard those workers had to fight to be able to get a wage increase with those companies. And so this is the kind of common sense policy that we think that workers and our supporters absolutely will be seeing as a step in the right direction. I think that the testimony we heard earlier, it's very hopeful that this could have an impact of lifting the bottom to be able to close that inequality gap. And should CEOs and their boards have hard conversations that don't result in those kinds of increases for their workers, I think that there's a really excellent common sense ways that this is addressing being able to have action that the city can take in the form of the surcharge. So we're very supportive and enthusiastic of the policy and are very grateful that we have such committed leaders who are taking on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of you? Thank you so much. Appreciate you being here. Anyone else wants to speak on this item? Come on up. Good afternoon.
Yeah, Mr. Shedrick, a little history or something is that when there's good economies, like you say right now, we can sometimes consider the leaders of corporations as gods, and they're running things, and only they should run their corporation, and they're like artists, like Steve Jobs, who do no wrong, and this is where the income comes from. But there are downturns, and I think given the debt and the stock market, there will be eventually downturns. And sometimes good government has to get involved. The case was, after the Great Depression, there was a General Motors strike in 1935 in which Franklin Delano Roosevelt was expected to send in the FBI and bust up the strikers. He did the opposite. He actually supported the strikers, managed their problems, and aided the CEO. So he investigated the situation and found out the striking workers had rights, like Commissioner Novick is suggesting.
Thank you. All right. Anyone else wants to speak on this item?
Thomas.
Questions for Sir Staff?
Yeah.
Thomas?
Or Terry? Or
Terry,
both
come on back up, please.
So how is, what is the definition of executive compensation? Is that taken care of in the SEC rulemaking?
Yeah, sent a memo. Let me...
It's
pretty all-inclusive.
It's defined.
It's my understanding. It is defined by the regulations that the SEC adopted.
It is. That's correct.
And it includes.
Okay, that's
yes.
All I need to know.
Okay.
And so, what is? Give me an estimate of what a 25% surcharge would be on the largest business income taxpayer in the city of Portland.
Do you have examples?
Oh right, we do have examples.
We have
here.
Some examples where we didn't necessarily. We took. It's not like the largest, but we've got a couple of different industries and some examples of what those might look like to get to discuss, so we can do that for you.
So we have one here, a large bank pays the city of Portland currently, and this is not exact, this is not an actual taxpayer, I want to be clear about that.
It's a conglomeration of
that. But this is a sort of a median impact to this industry. Large bank pays City of Portland currently $250,000 in tax. The CEO to median worker pay ratio for this example is 1,000 to 1. They would be above the 250 to 1, therefore subject to 25%. So their surtax would be $62,500 for a total of $312,500 tax owed. Another example, a large beverage company currently pays the City of Portland $100,000 in tax. The CEO to median worker pay is 175 to 1 in this example. This would be above the 10%. This would hit the 10% surtax. So their surtax would be $10,000. And the total tax due would be 110. And I could go on.
What was the ratio in that first example you gave?
1,000 to 1.
1,000 to 1.
And we've looked at some ratios that are well above 1,000 to 1 and verified those with media reports and other ways of benchmarking the data that we did get from that third-party source I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Other questions?
Well, I have a question for the sponsor. I'm really surprised that there are so few people here, either in support or opposition. And I'm wondering, had you been able to hear it on October 5th, were you expecting there'd be a lot more people on both sides?
Yes, we had a number of people from some of the organizations represented here who were prepared to testify. It's just hard to get everybody back again.
Ms. Haynes, presumably that's the same for the Portland Business Alliance, that you had people who were planning to come in on October 5th and weren't able to make it today? Yeah, thank you. I just, you know, calling it to everybody's attention because this is another problem with the democratic process in our city if people can't rely on when things are going to happen. So thank you very much tonight. Thank you for your perseverance and for getting your testimony in by telephone. I was spoiling for a fight, but I was really looking forward to some vigorous debate of the more polite and reasoned kind than we sometimes get on other issues. So thank you very much for all your work on this.
Thank you both.
I have a couple questions to Commissioner Novick. So I guess maybe I'm the biggest skeptic here on the dais. And not that, you know, I'm not an apologist for inequality in pay, but I have a hard time really believing this is going to really influence behavior at the level we're expecting in terms of reducing CEO pay or increasing median worker pay. I mean, just looking at the two examples that were given, an incremental 62,000 business license liability on a $250,000 bill for a 1,000 to 1 ratio, or it's just, you know, I'm hard pressed to be persuaded this is going to influence the type of behavior we want. I get it. There's the global movement. There's the national movement. There's Portland First. I get all that stuff. But as a practical matter, if this does not influence behavior, are you going to come back and say, well, let's increase the ratios. Let's jack it up to 100% or up to 50%. And I guess my philosophical concerns are I don't really support sort of designer taxes, and that's what this is. I mean, this is a designer tax. It's well-intended, and it's got a good intended outcome, but you know, what's to stop us from coming back and saying, well, let's do a business license fee surcharge based on carbon emissions, based on the lack of women and minority in the workforce of a particular company or companies. So, you know, where does it end?
Well, Commissioner, we do have any number of designer tax provisions. We give tax breaks for creation of affordable housing. There's the home mortgage interest deduction, which Commissioner Fish raises occasionally, which is originally suggested as a way to promote homeownership. We have a tax deduction for charitable contributions, which is designed to, I mean, the city doesn't, but
right. There's federal and state things, but not much at the city level.
And the tax code has often been used to promote certain behavior and also to signal disapproval of certain behavior. In the 1960s, it was partly was a matter of greater union bargaining power, but the fact that the average CEO in the 1960s made only 20 times what the typical worker made was partly the result of sort of a societal consensus that it was inappropriate for CEOs to be making these vast sums. I think that part of what we'd be doing here is sending a signal that, as far as we're concerned, these vast disparities are not appropriate, and I do think that there's every reason to believe that this proposal would be duplicated in other jurisdictions. There's already been national attention simply to this proposal. Robert Reich put up a Facebook post about it.
Well,
Sarah Anderson.
So I'm just saying, but if it doesn't influence the behavior in the way we want, are we going to come back and say, well, let's jack up the ratios because people aren't responding? And I guess I would also point out many local